Have you heard about the most popular boys' haircut in Kansas City recently? It is sweeping barbershops. If I were an entrepreneur, my family gets sick of me saying that. If I were an entrepreneur, I would do this. If I were an entrepreneur, I would get my clippers out, I would buy business storefront, and I would say, I can do the Mahomes better than anyone. I can shave those sides, I can get some gel, and I'll prop your hair up in the middle, and I'll put a headband on you that's wide and black and sticks on there, and I will get you set up, and then I would make some money, right? The Mahomes, it is taking the city, right? Have you seen the look of Patrick Mahomes? And why are kids getting their hair cut like him? Because last week you see him step back and he gets chased this way, so he runs 20 yards this way and back around 30 yards this way, and off of his right foot throws 30 yards on a dime, a bullet to a receiver in the back of the end zone who was running. The play is from a video game and he humanly did it, right? And what's the secret? It's his hair. It's his hair, that's it. You shave his head, Samson. He's done. It's his hair. His hair, and there's, I think, something in his contract about this. The Chiefs are highly protective. It's his hair. They want, kids want to be like him on the field and how he plays, and they think step one, it starts at the top, right? Starts with the hair. Kids have heroes, but so do adults. No one lives in a vacuum. You may be an older individual like me, approaching 50. No. A little older than that, maybe. I don't have heroes. No, you have heroes. There have been people you looked up to throughout your life, and they may no longer be living. They may be with the Lord. But the patterns of life that you observed in them, you follow. You take up the courses of activity, not just what they do, but sometimes how they did it. There are apprenticeships going on in our lives that we are not even cognizant of at times. We follow examples. A couple of weeks ago, I had the opportunity to attend a workshop event at Capitol Hill Baptist Church in Washington, D.C., Mark Dever is the pastor there. He's been there 20 plus, I think, now. 24 years, something like that. It's a more famous church. Maybe you have heard of it, or Mark Dever. He founded Nine Marks Ministries, which is not nine guys named Mark like him. But there are a few, I think, early on. But it's nine principles that are based upon a letter he wrote to a church who was looking to hire a pastor. It was actually a church that Mark Dever had pastored for a time, and then he went away to do studies, and that church couldn't find a pastor, so he wrote back, here are nine principles, nine marks, that you would want to follow as a church in finding this pastor, and that's become a ministry. It's a great organization, highly influential, and a delight. I was able to go. Some students from MBTS had organized a trip a little over a year ago, and they wanted a faculty member to go, and the student organized, hey, do you want to go with us? Yes, I'll certainly go. It'd be a great opportunity. And so then I was very excited, and as time approached, continued to be excited. But the pressures of life at times, you know, if you have to be away, you want to be home, though, there's that tension, even if it's something exciting. And we got to Washington, D.C., and I love D.C., very much. If I could live anywhere besides Kansas City, I think I'd choose D.C. I love the hustle and bustle, and it's just invigorating for me. It's fun to be there. And then the conference starts, and it's just jam-packed. There's not much of a break. So we're going, hearing speakers, and hearing this issue addressed and that issue addressed. Got to sit on an elders meeting. Part of this event is you're under the hood of Capitol Hill. So you attend everything that they do on a weekend. A couple of elders meetings, various activities, church service. And after church, everyone who's there goes to an elder's home for lunch. And it it's all arranged, and I was able to go to Mark Dever's house for lunch, so I get to hear him preach, and then his house is right across the parking lot to the church. It's where the church owns a whole row of houses there, and they have staff who live there, and one is Mark Dever's house. Got to walk in his back door, and all this food, and his wife's there. We're just crammed in this house. There are 15 or 20 of us who are eating there, and Mark Dever goes around, wants everyone to introduce themselves, make a comment about the event, ask any questions. And he's going around, and several people go and make a comment, ask a question. I looked at him, I said, I just can't wait to get out of here. And I said it in such a way that was kind of funny. I was trying to be funny. But it did calm the room just for a minute. I said, because I want to get home and be with my church. We already do so much of this. It was like I was being overfed. I felt like Thanksgiving night. And if you have a call to ministry and you are getting filled up that way, you want to go do that Thanksgiving night walk, right? I need to burn some of this off or I'm going to explode. So I just joked with him, I can't wait to get out of here. I want to get home and do this. And we had a good laugh for a few moments. But I wanted to come home. And the irony, though, is yet needing to be teased out some, because Mark Dever, I mean, he's a great individual. Humble, funny, gregarious. He's a congregationalist by ecclesiology, by church structure, because that's his life. He's around someone constantly. I mean, he just wants people around him. He wants making decisions together. It's just fun. Yeah. Personality and who he is. And some would look at that and say, well, you got this opportunity to go be with him and just be around him. He's heroic. He's heroic for many pastors. His influence is palpable even in our church. But I told many of you, and many of you were receiving texts from me 2 weeks ago in the morning, Saturday night, texting you. I was texting you because I wanted to be back here. I don't know how many texts, checking in on this, that activity. Let's think about this. I was planning the sermon schedule from the back row of the church in one of the breaks. I have got to do something with all I'm receiving. Truth be told, most of my heroes are in this room. I have an opportunity via MBTS and other places to hang out with some people who have a large platform. And I get to be around them in some personal settings, like dinner at their house. And they're great. But the patterns of life that I observe year after year from many of you are more inspiring to me than people with lots of letters behind their names or five digits of followers on Twitter. It's not platform that matters, and it's not fame. And some of us may need to begin today's sermon by repenting of Christian celebrityism, thinking that for someone to be heroic, for me to want to emulate them, they need to have a platform. They need to be recognizable. They need to be out there, well known. Someone I can latch on to, someone who can pull me up that way. That is a creeping sin in many evangelical churches. Today, I want you to think about not fame and heroism, but faithfulness. People who are faithful where they are at in their station of life, where God has put them, the circumstances of life around them, and how they are responding in light of what God has said about the categories of life that apply to them. Family, relationships, marriage, money, work, these kinds of ideas, faithfulness. Turn with me to Luke. We're looking at the end of chapter 20, and we are here in this last week of Jesus' life. And along the way, Luke has described how Jesus has been training his disciples in such a way that he's preparing them for the work that they will do after he is gone, to do alongside of him, but after. Even as early as Luke chapter 5, with the miraculous morning catch of fish, he begins to train the disciples. There, Peter, James, and John follow after Jesus, and there, Peter is repentant. Lord, go away from me. I'm a sinful man. I'm not believing you. I'm not trusting you yet. And Jesus says, come. From now on, you'll be catching men. I will make you fishers of people. This is leadership training. One way to think about the Gospels is via the grid of leadership training. And that is what Jesus is doing here. And if you're going to train leaders, you have to have examples for them. Examples to follow and patterns of life and people you would want them to avoid. And along the way, Jesus obviously setting himself as an example and one to follow. And along the way to avoid the leadership practices of Israel's Pharisees, scribes, and Sadducees. These various leaders and their particular nuances of how to practice Judaism and their roles and their offices, Jesus consistently says, don't be like them. And the reason he does so is because they are using their positions for self-interest. They are faithful to themselves, and when push comes to shove, they stand on God rather than standing beneath him. Their concern for the Old Testament law is to use it for their position's sake, not for its intent to show God and how to live. This is seen especially in chapter 20. Before we look at chapter 20, jump back just a moment, chapter 19, verses 47 to 48 for just a moment. Every day, Jesus was teaching in the temple complex. The chief priests and the scribes and the leaders of the people were looking for a way to destroy Jesus, but they could not find a way to do it because all the people were captivated by what they heard. The ideas here that Luke is setting out for us is somewhat of a table of contents for what is going to come these next couple of days as Jesus teaches before he's arrested. So, these couple of days, this is perhaps Tuesday of the week of Jesus' crucifixion. He's teaching, and he's continuing on to teach, and now Luke's going to begin to fill in what the content of that teaching is. And it begins in chapter 20 and following. If we picked it up in chapter 20 and verse 20, we see this interaction of Jesus and the religious leadership. People testing Jesus about taxes, then about more religious matters and interpretation of Israel's law, the Sadducees' question about the resurrection. And then Jesus, in verse 41, he turns the table on these leaders, and he asks them a question now, a question that helps them to interpret his grid of interpretation about his greatness and his coming. And in fact, David's Lord, not just David's son, but also David's Lord. And this sets out his authority. It's right in that scene that we pick ourselves up today with Jesus teaching about, in many ways, heroes. Who to avoid, who to emulate. Follow the text. Join me in verse 45. And notice what Jesus says about separating and not following the example of the Jewish leadership because of their hypocrisy. Verse 45, while all the people were listening, I catch us up at verse 20 at least and following, because that's fresh on folks' minds. We've been away for a couple of weeks, but this is fresh on their minds. While all the people were listening to what Jesus said about his own authority, about his own greatness, about the Sadducees' foolishness with the resurrection, about the need to pay to Caesar what is Caesar's and to God what's God's, that fresh in their minds, while they're listening, he turns to his disciples. This is an important note, perhaps minor here in the larger scope of text we're looking at, but Luke has, all throughout his gospel, particularized at times Jesus speaking to his disciples and then to larger crowds, or it's the crowds listening on while he's speaking to his disciples. But he turns here, so there are large numbers perhaps around. Luke has made that clear from the end of chapter 19 on, but he turns to his disciples. This is leadership training. This is a small group time, pulling them in. "Beware of the scribes," Jesus says, "who want to go around in long robes and who love greetings in the marketplaces, the front seats in the synagogues, and the places of honor at banquets." The language Jesus uses is for physical separation. It's distance. It's getting away from. The idea of beware of is the idea of leave, get away from, move away from. But it's not just scribes as people. Notice the text. What does Jesus qualify these scribes as? He describes them by what they love. It's not just them as individuals. It's how they behave. It's the patterns of life he's concerned about. And he says, beware of them because they have a loving desire. They're desiring certain things and loving certain things. Verse 46, they want and they love. The ideas might be able to fuse together. They have this earnest passion, this great desire, a passionate love for appearance. They have this passionate love for appearance, to be noticed, to be in a public situation and be recognized. Marketplaces, front seats in the synagogues, honor at banquets. They have a passionate love for appearance. And Jesus says, don't be like them. This is not the first time that Jesus has indicted Israel's leaders for this kind of behavior and this kind of a pattern of life. Flip back with me to chapter 14 for just a moment. Luke 14. I want to read with you verses 1 through 11 to recall a scene where a Pharisee invites Jesus to eat at his home. And it just so happens that at this Pharisee's home, there's a man with a disease that would qualify him as unclean. Yet somehow he's there when Jesus is invited, and the whole scenario is one of setup. They're wanting to see what Jesus would do, and they are willing to compromise their own scruples about the law, in this instance, to try to trap Jesus. One Sabbath, when he went to eat at the house of one of the leading Pharisees, they were watching him closely. Well, why? Well, there in front of Jesus was a man whose body was swollen with fluid. A man who was in pain, by the way. If you have swelling in a foot, perhaps, maybe even today, some of you have pain, yes? And if there's a chemical imbalance in your body where that swelling happens in the ancient world and it's very difficult to be rid of it, you would be filled with pain. You may have heart and lung problems. You would be lethargic. This is a man needing compassion. And they've brought him there as a test. In response, Jesus asked the law experts and the Pharisees, is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath or not? In their silence, Jesus took the man, healed him, and sent him away. And to them, Jesus said, which of you whose son or ox falls into a well will not immediately pull him out on the Sabbath day? They could find no answer, so it's right for Jesus to do this work on the Sabbath day. Verse 7, he told a parable to those who were invited when he noticed how they would choose the best place for themselves. When you're invited by someone to a wedding banquet, don't recline at the best place. This is just wisdom talking. A more distinguished person than you may have been invited by your host. The one who invited both of you may come and say to you, give your place to this man. In verse 9, you would be humiliated. Rather, verse 10, when you're invited, go and recline in the lowest place so that when one who invited you comes, he'll say, friend, move up higher. And you'll be honored in the presence of the other guests. For everyone, here's the key point, everyone who exalts himself will be, and the one who humbles himself will be. Back to the end of chapter 20 then. Don't be like them. Don't be like them. Distance yourselves from the patterns of their life. Don't be like them. But there's a further indictment, verse 47. Not only do they love these best places for themselves, they use their position to gain these best places, and they don't use their position to help people they should. This is leadership training, friends. When I talk to leaders, what I want you to do is I want you to use your position to help people, whatever the case. If you have more prominence, a greater platform, all the better. But if you will learn that God's way up is the way down, then you'll be blessed. God's way up is the way down. And these leaders don't get it yet. Rather, they are using their position to exalt themselves while they should be using it to help people. And notice what Jesus says, verse 47. They devour widows' houses and say long prayers just for show. Do you see the two phrases of verse 47? They devour widows' houses and make long prayers. Stop for a moment and do the logic on that. Do those two things go together? Devouring widows' houses, that sounds mean, cruel. Long prayers sounds pious, doesn't it? The idea of "and" here is the idea of a concession. They devour widows' houses, although they make long prayers. They make them just for show. Jesus is indicting them for hypocrisy. They act one way when they should be acting another. They use their platform to prop themselves up with long prayers while they should be helping widows. Joel Green writes, the legal experts distancing themselves from the population at large by their concerns with public honor manifest no concern for widows. Refusing any relationship to those who are representative of society's most vulnerable, they actually do violence to them. The long prayers of the legal experts may be nothing more than hoping to elevate their honor within the temple. Use their position to make themselves look great, and all the while ignoring those who are in need. The word devour may be a little strong for some of us. How are they devouring widows' houses? In the strict sense, it often designates consumption of food in a voracious manner. They're not eating these widows' houses. But it's a rhetorical way of expressing the idea that if someone has opportunity and means, the degree of opportunity and means they have, if it is not used in the right way, is actually devouring them, even though they may not directly be harming them. By not helping, they're hurting. Why? Because they have so much opportunity, and that's their position. Don't be like them, Jesus says. Avoid their patterns. And then Jesus looks up, verse 21. There in the temple, he looked up and saw the rich dropping their offerings into the temple treasury. And he saw a poor widow dropping in two tiny coins. We've seen throughout Luke that scenarios that just so happen to come about become teaching moments for Jesus. This is a beautiful gospel. Something happens and it becomes a teaching moment. Speaking of widows, verse 3, I tell you the truth, Jesus said, this poor widow has put in more than all of them. For all these people have put in gifts out of their surplus, but she, out of her poverty, has put in all she was having to live on. These temple treasuries, these big pots that may have been set up in the temple, people would come during the Passover to give gifts. One of the themes of the Old Testament, and it just can be followed in many places, is the generosity that Israel was expected to display toward God financially, often for the building of the tabernacle, the building of the temple. If we were going to begin chronologically, we would start in Exodus 35, where there's free will offerings for the temple to be constructed and leaders giving free will offerings. These plunderings of Egypt that they took out with them are now returned to God for the construction of the tabernacle. We would fast forward to 1 Chronicles 29 and the building of the temple itself. Not just the tabernacle, but David setting up Solomon to build the temple and people bringing money and giving it for the construction of the temple. The generosity, these free will offerings, people giving for the beauty of the temple. King Joash in 1 Kings 12, the temple is needing repaired, and he takes an offering for the building of the temple, for its repairs. This, in addition to the various sacrifices and the costliness of those, Numbers 27 to 28 establishes a pattern of those sacrifices and offerings that needed to be given and what that might cost, we certainly would understand would be significant. This is a pattern. People giving. So when Jesus sees, verse 1, people bringing in their offerings to the temple treasury, this is not something that's strange. This is normal. People would be giving their offerings, especially at this time. But he draws attention to the contrast. The rich are putting in offerings, verse 1, but there's a specification of what the widow put in, verse 2, two tiny coins. And Jesus says, which is greater? It's the widow. She's giving more. Why? It's the quality of it. It's the quality. But it's also the quantity, isn't it? These two relate. Here, quality and quantity go together because she's putting in all she has to live on. Because it represents her entire quantity, even though it's not much quantitatively to the rich person, it's qualitatively weightier because it's what she's trusting in. She's fully reliant upon God if she's a widow and she puts in everything, who's going to meet her needs? She's entrusting herself to God. One commentator writes, to be rich in ancient societies made one automatically part of the leadership classes. And so Jesus, in the last of the present series of critical engagement with the segments of the leadership classes, like Pharisees, Sadducees, scribes, earlier in chapter 20, he now turns his gaze upon the rich. Jesus contrasts the woman's evident passionate commitment to the cause of God with a notable corresponding lack in the giving of the rich. The rich are only giving from their leftovers, expressing no commitment at all, but the poor widow is said to give an expression of a passionate and wholehearted commitment. Because of the quality of her gift, in God's eyes, it has greater quantity. She's a hero. There's no doubt that the end of Luke 20 here, the beginning of chapter 21, set out for us a literary unit, a unit to be thought about together, a contrast, this and then this. Not like this, but like this. At this time, a few days before Jesus was crucified, calling his disciples in, after this teaching in the broader context of the temple, calling, this is leadership training. This is leadership one, this is it. God's way up is down. It's using your position to help other people. And that's heroic. And here's this widow who is an epitome of heroism because she's trusting God. God, if I don't have you, I have nothing. And if I have you, I have everything. This is her heart. She exemplifies the broader teachings of Luke's gospel, doesn't she? Isn't this exemplary discipleship? Isn't this what Jesus wants from his followers? Total trust in God, even if no one's looking. Or if everyone's looking. Who are your ministry heroes? We are in the midst of fellowship season, and it is true that the fellowship of any church directly reflects those, the individuals of the church look up to, who we aspire to emulate, what kind of patterns. I'm going to say just a few comments about those patterns in life and heroes. The first is this. Find heroes who trust in God. Find heroes who trust in God, who know His faithfulness, who rely upon Him, and I'm going to they trust themselves to God. They don't live just to be applauded. They don't live to be seen. They're the same kind of person whether everyone's watching or no one is. Because they're trusting in God who sees. They're faithful in the situation of life. Maybe we do need to continue to repent of celebrityism. My heroes, I have heroes who've never written a book, who don't have a public platform. Does that surprise you? Does it surprise you that a seminary professor thinks more highly in terms of Christianity of people who have secular, quote-unquote, jobs than some people who teach for a living? Does that surprise you? I hope it doesn't. My heroes are faithful husbands, faithful employees, faithful in who God has made them to be with the gifts He's given them to use. And some of those people are teachers or with a public platform. And we should look to them, learn from them. But that's not the standard. It's not fame, it's faithfulness. You are my heroes. I want to be like people of MCC, one of whom I'm married to. That's what I want to be like. That's what drives me. Second, trust in God for a second. Money will always be a measure of commitment to God. It will. And very quickly, if I could give just a bit of pastoral wisdom along this line for some of you thinking about pastoral work. It is by God's providence that I'm able to preach through Luke now. I would not have chosen to preach through Luke from 2008 to 2012 because of the recession. And the themes of money and generosity that are here in Luke, we need to hear now because most of us will make more in 2018 than we've made in our lives. Most of us will. If you have investments, they made more in the last couple of years than they've made in a lot of years. Some of them, a lot more. And it's time for us to think about our money and commitment to God. If you haven't recently increased your giving, but you're making more, that's time for you to do some analysis of your life. I wouldn't preach this back then when everyone was tight and we were losing. We as a church just hanging on. We got to keep going here. What do we got to cut? We don't have to do that now. We're surplused. So now's the time for us to think seriously about our commitment to God, and our pocketbooks will always show that. And I've seen it here, even in the last couple of weeks. I've heard of this person helping, others trying to chime in to help one another and to give. That shows your commitment to God, and it always will. It's not possible to say commitment to God and money not be a part of that. I want to tease out one just practical idea. We've thought about a widow here, the end of her life, just giving, and who knows what would happen next. I would encourage you, as your pastor, if you have not yet planned your funeral, to do so by the end of the year, perhaps the end of the week, and to put in that funeral plan a giving plan with life insurance if you have it. When my father passed away a few years ago, I was helping my mom get all the finances organized. And she received a check from the life insurance company. I think you had a couple of policies. Those came in. And we're thinking about this money. We want to make sure you're taken care of, Mom. But do you realize, Mom, you have an opportunity now with this money to maybe do more in my dad's death than in his life? Sort of like Samson here. There's a chance, because of the amount of money here, you could give a chunk of this and make a dent for the kingdom. You should think about that. What's the plan going to be? I think you should give to your family. Make sure things get taken care of. But first, why not God? And every time we earn, we give, don't we? Every time we earn, we give. That's just a natural pattern of life. Because money will always be a measure of commitment to God, what you do with it. And many of us right now could do more. We just could. I don't say that because we need more as a church right now, though we want to be good stewards of it and appreciate you praying that we could. But for many of us, the reason why we aren't growing like we wish we were is because we are holding back what we should be giving. And we could give more. Third, trust in God. Money will always be a measure of our spirituality. And my heroes are generous people, and I mean it. In this room, there are some people who are unbelievably generous. I've seen large amounts shift, and it's remarkable. That's why you're my heroes. I'm on tape, right? I'm on the internet now. That shows my age. Third, your life is ministry. Your life is. When we think about discipleship and heroes for ministry, your life is ministry. When you're at work, when you're with your family, when you're coaching your kids' ball team, this is ministry. This is who you are. If the Spirit is in you, if we know anything about the New Covenant, it makes clear that 2548 South 42nd Street, Kansas City, Kansas, is not the primary place of worship. It is a gathering place of worship, but you, wherever you are.
That's you, your life, your ministry. Go be a hero. Go be a hero there. Go be heroic in commitment to God and in coaching a team and on a job site with your family, on a date with your wife. Be a Christian hero there in faithfulness to God there. Would you pray with me? Lord, we recognize today your greatness, your power, the richness of the gospel. That you are the God who knows, you are the God who sees. You are the God who is great every day. Greatly to be praised. Worth living for. Lord, let us be patterns. Let us be heroic. We ask this in your Son's name.